on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, the concluding extract of Elizabeth's Women, a biography of Elizabeth I by Tracy Borman, that tells the story of her life through the eyes of the women who shaped and influenced her. The final years of the monarch's reign see her ladies-in-waiting and maids of honour behaving like flouting wenches. The reader is Emma Fielding.
Sir Walter Raleigh, one of the Queen's greatest favourites during the 1580s, denounced her ladies as being like witches, capable of doing great harm but no good. Having fallen into disgrace, he had attempted to use them as intermediaries with his royal mistress, but this had failed to regain Elizabeth's good opinion. Elizabeth's women were perceived to have so much influence that many of the great men at court sought their intervention. As one courtier wryly observed, "We worshipped no saints, but we prayed to ladies in the Queen's time." The assumption has often been that because the women of Elizabeth's household inhabited the private world of the Queen, they were kept quite separate from the political. But this underestimates the political importance of personal relationships in her court. It was a tightly knit world, in which almost all the occupants, female as well as male, were related by ties of blood, marriage or friendship. As her reign progressed, Elizabeth increasingly used her ladies as a source of information about affairs at court. As their presence was a good deal less obtrusive than the Queen's, they could listen in on conversations and report the contents back to their mistress. So effective were their networks that even the most important officials, such as Lord Burleigh, were often disconcerted to find that the Queen was already well acquainted with matters of which they had hoped to keep her in ignorance. As chief gentlewoman of the Privy Chamber, Blanche Parry was in charge of the Queen's personal papers, while the Privy Councillors and other officials were responsible for Her Majesty's state documents. But it was well known at court that sending official material to the Queen via her chief gentlewoman was an effective way of ensuring a positive result, because Blanche would often append her own comments in favour of the sender. Despite knowing the influence she could wield, Blanche made it clear that Elizabeth was the most important person in her life. Her constancy and devotion formed a marked contrast to the fickleness and backbiting of court life. Blanche was also a precious link with the past. By the 1580s, she was the only person in Elizabeth's life who could remember Anne Boleyn and who shared private reminiscences of her childhood. Little wonder, then, that when, on the 12th of February 1590, Mistress Parry died at 82, after 57 years of service, the Queen was bereft. Blanche left provision for a magnificent tomb to be erected at her home church of Bacton in Herefordshire. The epitaph attests to the personal sacrifice that her service to Elizabeth had entailed. "So that my time I thus did pass away, a maid in court, and never no man's wife, sworn of the Queen Elspeth's bedchamber always, with maiden queen a maid did end my life." Sir Francis Knowles, the aged vice-chamberlain of the Queen's household, found his duties ever more tiresome in the later years of the reign, thanks to the antics of the ladies and maids of honour, whose chamber adjoined his own. He complained that they would frisk and hay about in the next room, to his extreme disquiet at nights. As Elizabeth grew into old age, she became ever more intolerant of their audacious antics. More often than not, her outbursts at the flouting wenches of her household were prompted by her discovery that they had married or had affairs in secret. It seemed that almost every year there were scandals involving clandestine seduction, unwanted pregnancies or elopements. One of the most notorious scandals involved Elizabeth Throckmorton, better known as Bess. Bess had entered the Queen's service as a gentlewoman of the Privy Chamber in 1584, at the age of 19. She soon became one of Elizabeth's most trusted ladies, and was also something of a beauty, whose charms beguiled many men at court. Among Bess's admirers was Sir Walter Raleigh, the Queen's great favourite. Raleigh was some 21 years Elizabeth's junior, but he paid court to her like a lover, showering her with romantic poems, all praising her beauty and allure. A natural flirt, Raleigh was always careful to keep any liaisons from the Queen. But when the seductive young Bess Throckmorton caught his eye, he abandoned discretion, with catastrophic results. In July 1591, Bess discovered herself to be with child. No doubt aghast at the prospect of their secret being discovered, Sir Walter nevertheless did the honourable thing and made Bess his wife, and she continued with her duties in the Privy Chamber, hiding her swelling stomach. She finally secured a leave of absence from court when she was more than 8 months pregnant, and her sudden departure set tongues wagging. Sir Walter was at Chatham Docks, supervising preparations for an expedition to Panama, when he heard that his secret was being whispered throughout the court. He wrote with alarm to Robert Cecil and denied any involvement with Bess. Thus betrayed by her husband, Bess was forced to endure the ordeal of childbirth alone. On the 29th of March, 1592, she gave birth to a son, Damerai. Just 4 weeks later, and with some audacity, she resumed her duties to the Queen as if nothing had happened. But in late May, the scandal broke. Her illusions about Raleigh's ardent affection shattered. The Queen committed both Sir Walter and Bess to the Tower. Raleigh resorted to poetry in an attempt to win back the Queen's favour, but to no avail. Bess was unrepentant. Rather than seeking the Queen's pardon, she tried to use her network of contacts to secure her release. The fact that she signed all her letters to them, Elizabeth Raleigh, is an indication of her defiance. When Elizabeth heard of this, she resolved to keep her wayward gentlewoman in the Tower for perpetuity. By contrast, on the 15th of September, Raleigh was released from the Tower. As ever, the Queen had proved much more inclined to forgive the man than the woman. In October, London was hit by an outbreak of the plague, and it may have been this that killed Bess's young son, Damerai. Elizabeth's heart was so hardened towards Bess that she showed no sympathy at this tragic event. It was not until 2 months later, on the 22nd of December, that she finally granted Bess's release. The Queen made it clear that she would never again be admitted to her presence. Bess Throckmorton's betrayal was one of many to occur in the Queen's household during the later years of her reign. Anne Vavasour, a gentlewoman of the bedchamber, fell pregnant by the Earl of Oxford and actually gave birth in the maiden's chamber. A short while later, when the Queen suspected Lady Mary Howard of having an affair with the Earl of Essex, she lashed out in fury at her maids, reducing them to tears. The fact that Essex was already married had done nothing to restrain his licentiousness with the Queen's ladies. This marriage itself had been the source of scandal. Perhaps the Queen also knew that for all his flattery, Essex secretly mocked her as an old woman, no less crooked in mind than in body. Essex's remark was due to more than mockery. He had once burst into the Queen's bedchamber unannounced, and was aghast to find her stripped of her courtly finery, her grey hair and wrinkled face rendering her virtually unrecognisable from the carefully constructed image she presented to the world. Elizabeth was no less horrified, and it was said that the episode played as great a part in the Earl's downfall as his failed insurrection some time later. It is little wonder that the Queen took such care to shield her true appearance from all but her closest ladies. Ever more layers of makeup were applied to complete the so-called mask of youth. Her face, neck and hands were painted with ceruse, a mixture of white lead and vinegar. Her lips were coloured with a red paste made from beeswax and plant dye, and her eyes were lined with coal. Ironically, most of these cosmetics did more damage to the skin than ageing ever could. Cerussa was particularly corrosive. But Elizabeth insisted that she continue to be adorned with this and other dangerous cosmetics, and only ever let her closest ladies see what lay beneath. This was more than mere vanity on the Queen's part. It was essential that a sovereign be presented in as magnificent a style as possible in order to emphasise their divinely appointed status and authority. But despite all her efforts, the onset of old age was becoming increasingly obvious to everyone at court. The fading of Elizabeth's looks was mirrored in the loosening of her grip on the affairs of the court, where the formerly strict moral standards now began to decay rapidly. But she enjoyed good health almost until the end. She still rode in the hunt, enjoyed her accustomed long walks as if she had been only 18 years old, and danced energetically until well into her 60s. But even this formidable monarch could not defy time forever. In January 1603, the Queen left the court in Whitehall and moved to Richmond Palace, her warm box, to which she could best trust her sickly old age. She was accompanied by a small entourage of her ladies. The gulf between Elizabeth and the wayward young maids of honour who entered her service had grown ever greater as they fixed their sights upon the next regime. Women such as the Countess of Warwick, on the other hand, had served Elizabeth for more than 40 years and represented a treasured link with the ideals and traditions of Gloriana's heyday. Perhaps it was for this reason that the Queen sought her company above all others during her final illness. And having been surrounded by her mother's relatives throughout her reign, the Queen also made sure that one of them would be in attendance upon her now. The chosen lady was Philadelphia Scroope, née Carrie. Her attendants began to despair, as day after day she turned food and drink away. At length, the Queen was persuaded to retire to her bed. On the 23rd of March, Elizabeth suddenly rallied. With tears streaming down her cheeks, she exhorted her ministers to care for the peace of the realm. And when the Lord Admiral asked her if James VI should be her heir, she lifted her hand to her head and slowly drew a circle around it to indicate a crown. That evening, Elizabeth's counsellors, who had thronged into the royal bedchamber, departed. Only her ladies remained. Between 2 and 3 o'clock the following morning, their royal mistress breathed her last. Lady Scroope opened the window of the bedchamber and dropped a sapphire ring to her brother, Sir Robert Carey, who was waiting below. The ring had been given to her by James VI, who had instructed her to send it to him as a sign that the Queen was dead. It was to this new King of England that Sir Robert now rode with all haste. Elizabeth's funeral took place at Westminster Abbey on the 28th of April 1603. Crowds thronged the streets, and as Elizabeth's coffin passed by, divers of the beholders fell a-weeping, especially women. The magnificent funeral procession comprised more than 1,000 nobles, bishops, ministers, and courtiers, and 260 poor women, apparelled in black, with linen kerchiefs over their heads. Following directly behind the coffin were the Queen's ladies. As assiduous in serving their royal mistress in death as they had been in life.
Emma Fielding reading Elizabeth's Women by Tracy Borman. It was abridged by Katie Nicol and produced by Elizabeth Allard. Next week, Henry Goodman will be reading Christopher Bigsby's biography of the playwright Arthur Miller.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Now, what if the World Wide Web didn't just help us shop, travel and chat, but started thinking for itself? Ye gods! The internet wants a chat is our drama next. Today's 4 o'clock show will be a bumpy ride as we find out about the first bicycle, the Bone Shaker. And later, a master